Many as a fifth to a third of autistic people develop epilepsy, and they are helped by anti-seizure medications. The stimulant drugs commonly used for ADHD are sometimes prescribed to calm people with autism, as are various sedatives, and antipsychotics such as Haldol and Melaril. The results achieved with all of these treatments are inconsistent, and the effort and cost of initiating them is extreme. Even if an autistic person develops and sustains speech, functional skills, and a degree of social awareness, he will not become non-autistic. A distinctive cognitive profile will remain. Cameron Nazir described how he discovered in adulthood what is obvious to most children. I began to understand. A conversation is performance, merely a series of juxtapositions. I say something to you, a phrase in what I said, a topic, a point of view, or nothing at all, connects with something that you contain. Then you say something. And like this, we proceed. Such insights solve some challenges associated with autism, but they do not eliminate it. Bruce Spade was a professional photographer in London for some 27 years, and his eye for strange beauty shows in his lifetime of photographs of his autistic son, Robin. Pictures that look deeply at a person who is sometimes inexplicably tortured and sometimes exuberant, sometimes angry at the camera, and sometimes besotted with it. Robin is capable of great sweetness. He used to have this thing Harriet and I called grebing, Bruce said. I don't know if you've seen the great crested grebe doing a mating dance. They stand out of the water, and they shake their heads and make a lot of high-pitched sounds. Robin would look you in the eyes, and he would shake his head, and sometimes he'd say, look, look. And if he grebed at you, that was his sign. You were in. But Robin was also inexhaustible and exhausting. As he grew up and grew stronger, his explosions of rage became increasingly frightening. He'd have a tantrum in the street, and Bruce or Harriet would sit on him until he calmed down. Bruce and Harriet would have liked to have another child, someone who knew how to play, in Bruce's words, but they were too tired to contemplate that. When Robin was 9, he went off to boarding school. It was either that, or I had to give up work and go on the dole and look after him, Bruce said. The following year, when Robin came home for the summer, he was always hungry, and his mother couldn't say no. She wouldn't stop feeding him, Bruce said. The back of the car was littered with the packets. Robin enjoyed the eating, but he was gaining weight at a terrifying pace. He soon weighed nearly 300 pounds. It almost destroyed our marriage, Bruce said. Robin became anxious about walking because he was so huge. Soon, all his toenails became ingrown. Harriet had an affair. We've argued so much that it's gone beyond reconciliation, Bruce said. Harriet is always saying, it's time we divorced, but we never do it, because neither of us could handle this alone. Then Robin's school was closed down because a child escaped and died, revealing inadequate supervision that would fill any parent with anxiety. Only 2 schools in the UK would take someone as violent as Robin. Bruce and Harriet selected Hesley Village and College in Yorkshire, a Victorian farm on 54 acres with its own little hotel, a village green, a pub, a bistro, a hairdresser, a post office, and a bakery, all for 70 autistic people. The day Robin arrived, one of his new caregivers suggested they go for a walk, and Robin flew at him with a headbutt, jumped on top of him, and knocked him unconscious. Months of self-injury followed. Robin banged his head so hard that he would break through doors, and so frequently that he needed a skull X-ray. He scratched his skin until it bled. Then he got into the rhythm of the place, and the violence abated. Robin has a lively sexuality. He masturbates a lot, Bruce said. He tries to look up your nose. That turns him on. I suppose it's an orifice. He's got that much. He wants to look up mine, and sometimes I let him just for a minute, so he can get off. I don't want to discourage him, and he has so little pleasure in life, and this is something I can do for him. Not too difficult, if I don't let myself think about the fact that he's my son, and it's about sex. But I don't want to get him obsessed with nostrils, so I try not to do it too often. There is a girl at college. His pace quickens when he sees her. And although she is very noisy, and he is not really good with noise, he goes all coy when she is in the same room. Robin seems happier at Hesley now, but his erratic behavior continues. A few months before I met Bruce, Robin had come home on a break and couldn't sleep. After he had been awake for 4 days straight, Bruce and Harriet got a doctor to prescribe some sleeping pills. These enabled him to sleep for about 3 hours. When he awoke, he was thrashing around and seemed distraught, so Harriet sat on his bed to try to calm him down. He grabbed her hand and bit through her tendon. She had to go to hospital, Bruce said. She was shaking, in shock, and nearly unconscious. It was a terrible night. They took Robin back to college and wondered whether the visits home were more than he could handle. But then he came home again the week before last, and he was just lovely, affectionate, and a joy to be with, Bruce said. He put his dirty plates in the washer. That's huge progress. We become very proud, just as somebody else is if their child gets a first at Cambridge. In the cherry orchard, Chekhov said, when many remedies are proposed for a disease, that means the disease is incurable. Autism invites treatments that range from optimism to quackery. The list of such treatments of dubious efficacy is even longer than the list of treatments that bring about improvement. And parents with fantasies of perfect remission put themselves at the mercy of flamboyant visionaries who tout a range of bizarre procedures as breakthroughs. Barry Neil Kaufman and Samaria Light Kaufman developed Option Therapy and the associated Sunrise program in the 1980s to treat their own son, who they claim was completely cured of his autism. In fact, one commentator claims that doctors who treated the boy expressed doubt that he ever had autism at all. The program cost $2,000 for an initial consultation with parents, and then $11,500 for a one-week program with the child. A New York psychiatrist hatched holding therapy, in which parents physically restrain children when they exhibit problematical behavior. This seems to exacerbate tension in both children and parents. Bookstores overflow with books such as The Horse Boy, about a child who was supposedly led out of his autism by shamans in Mongolia. It sometimes seems that every parent whose child is thriving feels compelled to write a hubristic volume effectively called What I Did Right. Many such parents generalize from strategies that may only by chance have coincided with their children's emergence. While considerable time and money have been poured into such minimally tested behavioral and conceptual methods, these do not in general pose actual physical danger to children. Chelation, however, has great potential to cause long-term harm, and even greater potential to cause unnecessary short-term suffering. This procedure was originally developed to remove heavy metals from the bodies of wounded soldiers during World War I. Synthetic compounds are administered, usually intravenously, but sometimes intramuscularly or orally, to bind to metals, which are then excreted into the blood, urine, and hair. Chelation is recommended by advocates of the theory that a mercury-based preservative used in some vaccines causes autism. Although extensive research has failed to support its efficacy, as many as 1 in 12 American autistic children is estimated to have undergone chelation. At least one autistic child has died from hypocalcemia, a fatal drop in calcium levels leading to heart failure, during the procedure. Many more have experienced headaches, nausea, and depression. Some parents claim to have observed miraculous improvements as a result of chelation, and those claims, made in sincerity, have led to a burgeoning, often underground and largely unregulated business in the chemical detoxification of autistic children. A patent-pending protocol using Lupron, a castration drug that changes the body as profoundly as any medication can, conflates the possible effects of prenatal testosterone on the development of autism with normal puberty. It has been championed by a father-son team despite a lack of any verifiable evidence for its efficacy. Finding that their practice constitutes a danger to the patient community, the Maryland Board of Physicians and authorities in at least six other states have suspended the father's medical license, while the son, who is not a doctor, has been charged with practicing medicine without a license. Other physical interventions, putting children in hyperbaric oxygen chambers, putting them in tanks with dolphins, giving them blue-green algae, or megadosing them on vitamins, are usually neither harmful nor helpful, though they can have dangers, are certainly disorienting, and cost a lot. The first time I met Amy Wolf, she said of her daughter, Angela, "She has no speech and is frequently incontinent, is in a full-time, round-the-clock care facility, is beautiful and loves us, and can't be in the world without help for a minute. She walks and enjoys it. She can't button a button. She can sort silverware, can eat with a fork, a spoon is a little tricky, can't cut things, needs a straw a lot of the time. Has very little fear and awareness, so she would walk in the middle of the busy street if you took your eyes off her. She understands more than she can express. How much? No one has figured out. She takes pleasure in things. Sometimes, she's quite distant. Sometimes, she's bright and makes a lot of contact. Sometimes, when she sees me, she's overjoyed, which is fantastic. She likes people, just not too many at once. She hates the doctor, hates the dentist, hates the shoe store, hates the hairdresser, hates big parties, hates surprises, hates change in routine, and generally seems quite at peace with her life at this point. The first 14 years were hellacious. In 1972, age 20, Amy decided to leave behind the life of urban sophistication in which she had been brought up in New York and move to an alternative community in Taos, New Mexico. She married a healer and acupuncturist, and in 1979 became pregnant. When Angela was born, it was immediately clear that there were problems. She was put into a full-body brace to correct a contorted frame, a displaced hip, and what looked like a clubfoot. Angela's body was hypotonic, with loose, elastic muscles that didn't keep her limbs in place like a rag doll. She didn't walk until she was almost two. Words came, but slowly, and she was pitifully thin. Taos offered few supports. There were no antidepressants, Amy recalled. There were no services, no internet, no therapists. There were outhouses, apricots drying, Indian pueblos, yurts, hippies, Hispanic ancient culture, and Native American ritual. And Angela and me, somehow very apart from this community that I had held very dear. Her husband, healer though he claimed to be, could not cope with a disabled child, and he fled. When Angela was three, Amy divorced and brought her back to New York to start again. At that age, Angela had some speech and could recite "Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star." She could pick out the family car in the street. She was beginning toilet training. Then, bit by bit, it all fell away. She lost speech and became incontinent. Her muscle tone didn't improve. Amy had a long history with substance abuse, and she spun out of control. I was driving when she was about 4, drunk, with her in the back seat, having poured vodka down her throat while she was in the car seat, thinking I'd kill us both by driving down an embankment into the Long Island Sound, Amy recalled. Instead, she joined Alcoholics Anonymous and has been sober ever since. With the support of her parents, she began looking for cures. Angela was never aggressive to anyone else, but she was often self-injurious. Mostly, though, she was just out of control and sometimes deeply distressed and generally incomprehensible. When Angela was 7, a colleague told Amy about a Japanese woman, Kiyo Kitahara, who had achieved astonishing improvements with autistic children. She had founded a school in Kichijoji, Japan, a suburb of Tokyo. Amy met with her in Boston. Her interpreter offered, "Mrs. Kitahara says, put your burdens on our shoulders. Mrs. Kitahara can have Angela speaking within 6 months, but you will have to bring her to Japan." So Amy and her mother took Angela to Tokyo and entered her in the Higashi School. Amy was then physically blocked from entering the grounds and could see Angela only during her athletic periods through a barbed wire fence. "I stayed in Tokyo and looked at her every day through this fence," Amy recalled. "She seemed okay. They had her rollerblading a lot. We subsequently discovered that she was being deprived of water to toilet train her. It all got very dark and strange. It took 5 months, and then I just gathered my precious child and got the hell out of Dodge." A Higashi school was later established in Boston, but has been repeatedly dogged by allegations of physical cruelty and assault on its disabled students. Amy held on to her dream of a healthy child. "Another baby I craved, another baby I had. Until I had Noah, I was in psychological pain continuously, and the decision to have him helped with the scars." She found pregnancy terrifying and was tested to within an inch of my life, she recalled. Amy's parents paid to construct a group home to be managed by the Nassau County Mental Health Association, and 11-year-old Angela moved there shortly before Noah was born. "When I met Noah, he was in high school and doing volunteer work as a music therapist for autistic children. From the age of 6, he would see someone blind and cross the street to help them," Amy said. "He is opened up spiritually, yet free of all the rage that I still hold." Noah concurred. "It's just taught me a lot of tolerance and acceptance. Like if someone says retarded around Mom, God, it's like unnecessarily stupid what she does. Even if she's known the person for 5 seconds, she just goes for it. In all my dreams of her, she talks to me still," Amy said. "Letting go of speech was terrible, and letting go of the toileting just happened this year. Letting go is a continuous experience. It never finishes. I have to keep my rage in check. I have to keep my sobriety in check. I've experienced close family members suggesting that I kill her, and they would help me. I've experienced people offering the most idiotic possible cures, stuff to put in the bathtub and gripe water, and handing me copies of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and bullshit galore. I've also experienced the great inequality in the way our pay scales are structured, since the people who do the hands-on clinical work with this population are so energetic and so frequently expert and inspired, and they're making what waiters and waitresses make. A good measure of a society is how well it takes care of its sick people. Our society is an outrage." Amy spoke with the passion of someone running for office. "My story includes a continuous heartache that transcends everything else. There's no sense of time. It's just the same and the same. I forget how old I am because I can't measure it in these ways." While the deficits of autism are famous, the general public is less aware that people with autism may also have major abilities that the rest of us lack. Autistic subjects tend to perform better than others on certain cognitive tests, such as spatial thinking assessments. Joyce Chung, whose daughter has autism and who served as autism coordinator at the NIMH, said, "If you remove the capacity for someone to become autistic, would that also remove the things that make us interesting as human beings? Maybe the same genetic structures also produce creativity and diversity." Thorkil Sonne, an executive in a Danish telecommunications firm and the father of an autistic child, has set up a specialist agency in Copenhagen that places people with autism on corporate projects, presenting them not as deficient individuals to be hired out of charity, but as people with singular skills. But the notion of uncanny genius can also be used to objectify autistic people. John Elder Robison writes, "Being a savant is a mixed blessing, because that laser-like focus often comes at a cost. Very limited abilities in non-savant areas. Some of my designs were true masterpieces of economy and functionality. Many people told me they were expressions of a creative genius, and today I can't understand them at all. My story isn't sad, though, because my mind didn't fade or die. It just rewired itself. I'm sure my mind has the same power it always did, but in a more broadly focused configuration." I have heard Temple Grandin say the same thing, and my friend who played the Philip Glass CD told me that as his social abilities improved, his pure mathematical thinking weakened. The cure can be its own disease. When you take away what's perceived as wrong, you may also take away the person's gift. I first met Temple Grandin when she was 60, and famous for her ability to narrate her own autistic consciousness to non-autistic people. A cattle handler and livestock facilities designer whose equipment is now used in the majority of U.S. slaughterhouses, Grandin claims that she experiences fear as her primary emotion and has an overdeveloped startle reflex of the kind that protects animals from predators. "I think in pictures," she said. "I realized that should be able to help me figure out about animals, because I think more the way an animal does." The cattle industry struck her as both inefficient and inhumane. Her objective has always been to improve the treatment of animals, which she believes she can do most effectively by reforming the places where they are killed. When she was diagnosed as a child in the early 1950s, Temple showed the full range of autistic symptoms, and her mother, Eustacia Cutler, was told that she was a refrigerator mother. Eustacia could cope with Temple's strange behavior, but not with the emotional chill. "Tantrums are hard to handle, and fecal smears are smelly, but exclusion breaks the heart," Eustacia wrote in a memoir. "Be fruitful and multiply," God whispers in our ear, and leaves us to deal with the mess. Temple recalled, "When I was 2 1/2, I would sit there smelling space, eating carpet fuzz, screaming, stereotypic behavior." Her mother invented her own behaviorist system to help Temple, and she and the nanny she hired kept Temple constantly interacting. "When I met Eustacia," she explained, "you have to pull them out of the limbo of their self-absorption." Temple was given art lessons and showed a talent for perspective drawing. Her mother did all she could to encourage this skill. "You want to be appreciated for doing something other people want," Temple recalled. "When the kid is really little, you've got to get somebody to just spend 38 hours a week working with that kid, keeping them engaged. I don't think the method matters that much." She expresses considerable gratitude for the attention she received. "They put kids like me in institutions then. I had 15 years of non-stop panic attacks, which was hard on everyone. If I hadn't found antidepressants in my early 30s, I would have been ripped apart by stress-related health problems like colitis. I was very lucky to get some really good mentors when I was in college. She paused and looked at me as though she had just surprised herself. I mean, what would have happened to me if my mother had put me away instead? I hate to even think about it. Eustacia found that she had to invent everything. Why didn't the doctors know as much as I did, she wondered when we spoke. As an adolescent, Temple said to her mother, I can't love. Eustacia wrote, Adolescence is hard enough for any child, but autistic adolescence is something devised by the devil. But Temple's boarding school had a stable full of abused horses that the headmaster had bought cheaply, and Temple found her joy in caring for them. Many years later, Eustacia could admire whom Temple had become. Slowly, with no innate concept, no intuitive clue, conscious intelligence her only guide, and even then not sure, she's taught herself over the years to meet the faces that you meet. How bright and brave of her to want to meet us anyway, armed with such a flimsy homemade mask. Autism is an exaggeration of what lies in us all, and studying it has been my form of exorcism. This does not mean that it has been free of disappointments. Despite her extraordinary accomplishments, she knows that some part of the dream that I call life lies a little beyond her. It accounts for her hunger to have me understand her dream, that she won't be forgotten. Her longing for some kind of recognition is so palpably real, as if love were too shaky and mysterious to rely on. Temple receives thousands of letters from parents and readily offers advice. Some of these kids, you've got to jerk them out of it. If you're not somewhat intrusive, you're not going to get anywhere with them, she said. Temple advocates behavioral and medical treatment, and anything to engender literacy. Your kid is throwing a fit in Walmart because he feels like he's inside the speaker at a rock concert. He's seeing like a kaleidoscope, hearings fading in and out and full of static. I think some of those kids are getting scrambled HBO. But every once in a while, you get a little bit of an image in that scrambled HBO. Temple believes firmly that the higher functioning you can make someone, the happier he is likely to be. Autistic children should develop skills consistent with their capacities. You've got a kid who loves geology. Well, instead of developing his interest into a career, parents and teachers and therapists get hung up on social skills training. And social skills training's really important. But don't get so hung up on that that you neglect his gifts. Temple Grandin attributes her success to her autism. Genius is an abnormality, too, she explained to me. Without being self-aggrandizing, Temple has made what the world calls illness the cornerstone of her brilliance. Into all of this comes the neurodiversity movement, with its celebration of some aspects of autism. One of the leading autism charities was called Cure Autism Now, since merged with Autism Speaks. While opposing a cure for autism is a bit like opposing intergalactic travel, one of the battle cries of neurodiversity is, don't cure autism now. Like the rest of identity politics, this is an attitude forged and burnished in opposition to prejudice, treading a fine line between revealing a fundamental truth and attempting to create that truth. Conservatives complain that asking the larger society to accept autistic people's atypical social logic undermines the very principles that make it a society. Members of the neurodiversity movement take exception to the idea that autistic behavior lacks social coherence and maintain that it is a different and equally valid system. They fight for their own definition of civil justice. Thomas Insull said, "It's really important that we recognize schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or autism as something that's happened to someone, that there still is someone there who can fight against the illness." Jim Sinclair, an autistic adult and the co-founder of Autism Network International, wrote, "Autism isn't something a person has, or a shell that a person is trapped inside. There's no normal child hidden behind the autism. Autism is a way of being. It is pervasive. It colors every experience, every sensation, perception, thought, emotion, and encounter. Every aspect of existence. It is not possible to separate the autism from the person. And if it were possible, the person you'd have left would not be the same person you started with." The politically correct terminology in most of the world of disability is to identify the person ahead of the condition. You speak of a person with deafness rather than a deaf person, or a person with dwarfism rather than a dwarf. Some autism advocates take issue with the idea that they are a self with something added, preferring autistic person to person with autism. Others favor autistic as a noun, as in, autistics should receive social accommodation. Sinclair has compared person with autism to describing a man as a person with maleness, or a Catholic as a person with Catholicism. Many neurodiversity activists question whether existing treatments are for the benefit of autistic people or for the comfort of their parents. Idiosyncrasies may be unsettling, but how much torment should a child go through to relinquish them? Isabel Rapin said of her adult patients, "We shouldn't impose our values of success onto people who really have very different needs." Joyce Chung, who has an autistic daughter, said, "Our struggle was not to let ourselves experience our child's condition as a narcissistic injury." In other words, the autism is something that has happened to the child, rather than to the parents. Alex Plank, who has Asperger syndrome, and whose Wrong Planet website, an affirming forum for people with autism and their families, has over 45,000 members, said, "The organizations that have the best connections are the ones founded by parents of people with autism, which aren't going to have the same priorities as the autistic people themselves, especially if those parents' idea of success is to make their kid the same as the parents were when they were kids." Ari Naiman, who has Asperger syndrome and became a prominent self-advocate while still in college, uses the colloquial Aspie to describe himself. He said, "Society has developed a tendency to examine things from the point of view of a bell curve. How far away am I from normal? What can I do to fit in better? But what is on top of the bell curve? Mediocrity. That is the fate of American society if we insist upon pathologizing difference." In December 2007, the NYU Child Study Center produced a series of advertisements for their treatment program in the form of ransom notes. One ominously announced, "We have your son. We will make sure he will not be able to care for himself or interact socially as long as he lives. This is only the beginning." It was signed, "Autism." Another said, "We have your son. We are destroying his ability for social interaction and driving him into a life of complete isolation. It's up to you now." And was signed, "Asperger Syndrome." Harold Koplowitz, then director of the center, hoped to propel children with untreated mental health problems into the hands of competent professionals. But the ads were judged demeaning and stigmatizing by many people, including some with autism spectrum disorders. Autism activists spearheaded a campaign against them. The chief organizer was Naiman. In a memo to the members of his autistic self-advocacy network, he wrote, "This highly offensive ad campaign relies on some of the oldest and most offensive disability stereotypes to frighten parents into making use of the NYU Child Study Center's services. While people with diagnoses of autism and Asperger's often have difficulty with some forms of social interaction. We are not incapable of it, and can succeed and thrive on our own terms, when supported, accepted, and included for who we are. Naiman initiated a letter-writing campaign and recruited major American disability groups to support his position. The campaign rapidly escalated and was soon reported in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Koplowitz was stunned by the protests. On December 17th, he insisted the ads were there to stay, but the revolt was escalating, and 2 days later they were pulled. It was a signal triumph for the neurodiversity movement and for the broader community that endorses disability rights. In the aftermath of the debacle, Koplowitz conducted an online town hall meeting, and more than 400 people participated. Ari Naiman is not without social graces, but you can feel the effort in them. He said, "Neurotypical social interaction is like a second language. One can learn a second language with great fluency, but no one will ever be as comfortable in it as in one's own tongue." When Naiman was in high school, his intellectual skills, social deficits, and unusual learning style meant that he was considered both disabled and gifted, which made for trouble figuring out what classes he should take. There's this stereotype out there of the shiny Aspie, but you have to recognize and respect human difference and the diversity of human neurology, regardless of whether somebody's academically brilliant, Naiman said. As a public relations point, it's nice to have Vernon Smith, who has Asperger's and won the Nobel in economics, or Tim Page, who has Asperger's and won a Pulitzer. It's a point in favor of respecting and recognizing the legitimacy of human neurological diversity. But it would be a deep mistake to say that people should have their differences respected only if they can deliver some special talent. In 2010, age 20, Naiman was appointed by President Obama to the National Council on Disability. His selection met a firestorm of criticism from those who argued that his positive characterization of autism would reduce funds needed to treat their children. The term neurodiversity was originally coined by Judy Singer, an Australian sociologist whose mother and daughter both have Asperger's and who is herself on the spectrum. "I was at a workshop at a synagogue where they were trying to get us to come up with a better set of 10 commandments than God's," she said. "My first was honor diversity." Singer and the American journalist Harvey Bloom were thinking along parallel lines, and though she first used the word, he was the first to publish it in 1998. "We both noticed that psychotherapy was waning and neurology was on the rise," Singer said. "I was interested in the liberatory activist aspects of it, to do for people who were neurologically different what feminism and gay rights had done for their constituencies." The movement accelerated with a broadening of the spectrum and with increased communication among autistic people. "The internet," Singer said, "is a prosthetic device for people who can't socialize without it. For anyone challenged by language and social rules, a communication system that does not operate in real time is a godsend." Camille Clark, who blogged for some years as Autism Diva, is diagnosed with Asperger syndrome, has been an important voice for neurodiversity, and is mother to an adult child with autism and spina bifida. "Autistic children love their parents," she said. "You may have to learn to see how your child expresses affection, and not take it personally if your child doesn't show affection as typical children do. Deaf children may never speak the words, 'I love you,' and deaf parents may never hear those words, but that doesn't mean that deaf children don't love their parents. For many Asperger syndrome and autistic people, just being in the presence of others is as much work as it is for a normally social NT, neurotypical, person to host a big party. Many autistic people find eye contact unsettling." Kathleen Seidel, founder of neurodiversity.com, said that she learned to avert her own gaze as a means of respecting her son's needs. He, in turn, knew that physical contact had value to her and would occasionally give her a hug. Clark feels that the concept of neurodiversity extends well beyond autism. People with bipolar, schizophrenia, dyslexia, Tourette's, and so forth ought to subscribe to it, she wrote to me. Parents of autistic kids should be reasonable about what they can or can't do, and they shouldn't expect that their kid is ever going to be normal. Autistic people are valuable as they are. They don't have value only if they can be transformed into less obviously autistic people. Jim Sinclair wrote, "The ways we relate are different. Push for the things your expectations tell you are normal, and you'll find frustration, disappointment, resentment, maybe even rage and hatred. Approach respectfully, without preconceptions, and with openness to learning new things, and you'll find a world you could never have imagined." One activist commented to me that the attempts to cure autistic people are less like a cure for cancer than a cure for left-handedness. Many neurodiversity activists fear that in the event of a genetic test, selective abortion would result in genocide. "I don't want to get old and know that there will be no more people like me being born," said Gareth Nelson, a man with Asperger syndrome who co-founded the website Aspies for Freedom. As with most of the conditions in this book, the abortion question is emblematic of the tension between identity and illness models. Naiman said, "We have never said that autism does not represent a disability, but that it doesn't represent a disease. Give autistic individuals the educational opportunities and the opportunities to prosper and do well on our own terms." Seidel said, "I have never ruled out the possibility that genetic research might yield helpful therapies for problems often experienced by autistic people. I'm all for the development of antagonists that might, for example, correct impairments in oral motor function or serotonin metabolism, alleviate chronic anxiety, reduce a tendency to overstimulation, or decrease aggression. But I am primarily concerned about how to make life positive for the people on the autism spectrum who are here now, a group that happens to include my own child." Some parents of severely autistic children dismiss the articulate self-advocates as not really being autistic. There's a central irony here. The increased rate of diagnosis is crucial to the claim that there is an epidemic, critical in lobbying for resources for research. But the higher functioning people whose inclusion has brought up the numbers are often the ones who advocate against some of that research. Roy Richard Grinker, husband of Joyce Chung and author of Unstrange Minds, a book arguing that there is no epidemic, said, "At both ends of that spectrum, there's an anti-science perspective. The neurodiversity people are furious that the scientists want to cure autism. The anti-vaccine people are furious that the scientists won't do the studies they know should be done. Their premises are so different that any true dialogue is impossible. They're unable to speak with each other because they have such different epistemological and philosophical foundations." Thomas Insull said, "This is the most polarized, fragmented community I know of. I think those kids have something seriously wrong with them, and when you start to argue that they just need to be accepted for who they are, you're selling them and yourself terribly short. I don't think we would do that with most cancers or with infectious diseases. I sure hope we don't do it for people who have a brain disorder like this. Most parents want their kids to live the fullest life possible, and that's not possible when you're not toilet trained, and it's not possible when you don't have any language. Please don't write about them. Lenny Schaefer, editor of the Schaefer Autism Report, said to me when I mentioned neurodiversity. They're a handful of noisy people who get a lot of media attention. They're trivializing what autism really is. It's like stealing money from the tin cup of a blind man when you say that it's not an illness. You are getting the people who should be making political and social change to think that it's not a problem. You are slowing down funding for research. Other critics are even more vehement. John Best, parent of a child with autism, is author of the Hating Autism blog. One recent post showed a monkey engaged in autofellatio, labeled, "A neurodiverse nitwit ponders the vaccine trial." The Anti-Neurodiversity, Anti-Genetics, Age of Autism blog featured a Thanksgiving card with a photoshopped image of Alison Singer, Thomas Insel, and others who don't support the vaccine hypothesis eating a baby for their holiday meal. Seidel referred to Insel's assertion that autism takes away the soul of the child as a histrionic and stigmatizing assertion. She explained, "I don't believe that he has ever cited any specific examples of parents whose overacceptance has led them to neglect their children's medical needs, or to deprive their children of an appropriate education, or to allow their children to descend into a state of self-indulgent incontinence, or to prevent their children from learning to communicate as best they can, or to stymie research into the causes and treatment of specific problems associated with autism." People such as Lenny Schaefer set up this straw man, saying, "Oh, the neurodiversity people just want to let autistic kids rot in the corner and never have anything that will help them." That's bullshit. No parent in their right mind would let their kid rot in a corner. On the other side, Kit Weintraub, who has two children with autism, wrote, "The fact that my children have an abnormality of development does not mean that I do not love my children for who they are. As with any other condition that would threaten their future and their happiness, I do as much as I can to help them be as functional and as normal as possible. And no, normal to me does not mean a cookie-cutter robot child trained to do my will. It means able, like most people without autism, to lead an independent, purpose-filled life, able to speak, able to communicate, able to form and keep relationships." Some autistic people resent the perception that the activists who celebrate aspects of autism are speaking on their behalf. Jonathan Mitchell, an autistic man who wars with the neurodiversity movement on his blog, said, "The neurodiverse reach a vulnerable audience as many persons on the spectrum have been disaffected from society. Autistic people feel worthless and have low self-esteem, and neurodiversity provides a tempting escape valve. The same is true for parents of sometimes severely autistic children who want to see their offspring as something other than deficient or broken." Of course, the broader disability rights movement can be intolerant of science. Judy Singer said, "I fell out with the disability rights movement because they were so sociologically oriented, they were almost the same as creationists in their hatred of biology." Members of the neurodiversity movement, though, do not in most instances deny biology. The presence of the prefix neuro makes it clear that biology is part of the argument. What they probe is the meaning of that biology. Much of the antipathy results from divergent ideas of love. Many people who champion ABA, or support the vaccine hypothesis, believe that families who don't accept their views are consigning their children to ruin. Many neurodiversity activists think that ABA is dehumanizing, and the vaccine hypothesis is insulting. Clark has argued that ABA is suitable only for animals. Seidel believes that the parents who describe their autistic children as vaccine victims are disparaging their own progeny. I am very concerned about the long-term, deep psychological impact on my child of the proliferation of the erroneous concept that people on the autism spectrum are poisoned. It's scientifically incorrect and symbolically offensive. It's naive to criticize some autism activists for being autistic, idiosyncratic, single-minded, detail-oriented, not predisposed to imagine how listeners might respond to their words, and reluctant to compromise on a position unless offered a rational, intellectually supportable reason to do so. These qualities make autistic people somewhat less persuasive activists than they might wish, activism being in general helped considerably by charm. It's harder to account for the aggression of the anti-neurodiversity movement. Schaefer complains that neurodiversity activists see us as being less than loving, as evil, and that's just not who we are. Yet it is the anti-neurodiversity people who, on the Evidence of Harm discussion list on Yahoo, have accused their opponents of being lazy, vaccine barbarians, cheap whores, motivated only by a paycheck, and high-minded fascist germ freaks, disseminating malicious public relations hyperbole. Sarah Spence, a pediatric neurologist who worked at the NIMH, said, "When we mitigate some of the underlying symptoms for people with severe autism, they do seem happier. As a clinician, you don't feel that they love being in their world. They want to break out. We'd like to accommodate the politics of neurodiversity, but science and clinical support have to go before politics." Simon Baron Cohen said, "Autism is both a disability and a difference. We need to find ways of alleviating the disability while respecting and valuing the difference." The attempt to dictate black and white policy about a spectrum condition is inherently flawed. Some people are frustrated by not being able to communicate well, and some seem not to mind. Others accept that speech is difficult or impossible for them and communicate with keyboards and other assistive technologies. Others yet, by careful observation, develop enough skills to get by. Some people are shattered by their social deficits, and others are largely uninterested in friendship, and others still make friends in their own way. Some people are devastated by their autism, some are proud of their autism, and some simply accept it as a fact of their life. There is social conditioning here. Those who are regularly disparaged are less likely to feel good about themselves than those who receive supportive messages. But there is also a question of personality. Some autistic people are optimistic and buoyant, and some are withdrawn and depressed. Autism coincides with the full personality range to be found in the neurotypical population. Stephen Hyman said, "Severity, of course, matters. A certain amount is your life goals and whether you can achieve them, and whether you're experiencing distress and disability as a result of how you think and feel, or whether you are happy with the way you are." Insel said, "For those who are most disabled, the neurodiversity approach is threatening. On the other end of the spectrum, it will help people to accept themselves in the same way it encourages us to accept their uniqueness. What I'm hearing from some part of that community is that if you accept us for who we are, it also means that you'll help us to become everything we can be." Jennifer Franklin, mother of Anna, spoke with passion about such manifestos. "If Anna Livia were an adult who wanted to wear diapers and not be potty trained, I'm down with anything. I'd like nothing more than for her to develop the kind of consciousness that would allow her to join the neurodiversity movement. If Anna got to the point where she could tell a therapist, my mom is a bitch for putting me through this, I would feel like I did my job. Grandin argues that both the autistic person and the society have to make accommodation. She described the suffering of people who couldn't communicate, had toileting challenges, and were injuring themselves regularly. It would be nice if you could prevent the most severe forms of nonverbal autism, she said. But if you got rid of all the autism genetics, you'd get rid of scientists, musicians, mathematicians, and all you'd have left is dried-up bureaucrats. I see a picture in my mind of the cavemen talking around the campfire. And off in the corner, there's the Aspie guy, and he's chipping the first stone spear, figuring out how to tie it to a stick, cutting some animal sinews to do it. Social people don't make technology. In a rebuttal of the suggestion that only those with few of the problems experienced by severely impaired autistic people are active in the neurodiversity community, however, the three webmasters of autistics.org issued a statement affirming that none of them is fully toilet trained and that one has no speech. We flap, finger flick, rock, twist, rub, clap, bounce, squeal, hum, scream, hiss, and tick, they wrote, asserting that such behaviors do not impede their happiness. In a video called In My Language, the neurodiversity activist Amanda Baggs described her perspective. Baggs has repetitive behaviors and no speech. The way I think and respond to things looks and feels so different from standard concepts that some people do not consider it thought at all, she says. It is only when I type something in your language that you refer to me as having communication. People like me are officially described as mysterious and puzzling, rather than anyone admitting that it is themselves who are confused. Only when the many shapes of personhood are recognized will justice and human rights be possible. Jane Meyerding, who is diagnosed with Asperger syndrome and works at the University of Washington, wrote, "If people on the autism spectrum all came out and worked toward increasing institutional flexibility to the point where our special needs could be accommodated, the world would be a much more comfortable, less alienating place for everyone else as well. Such a world would be one where it would be as normal for children to have different learning styles as it is to have different colors and textures of hair, where everyone would have an accent." Joyce Chung described how her daughter, when struggling over something she can't quite articulate, finally explained, "I think that's because of my autism, Mama." Would such a statement have been possible 20 years ago? And is the capacity for such self-accepting self-awareness a hallmark of maturity, liberation, even of triumph over the illness? "When people pity me for my daughter, I don't understand the sentiment," Roy Richard Grinker wrote. "Autism is less a disease to be hidden than a disability to be accommodated. It is less a stigma reflecting badly on her family than a variation of human existence." Kate Movius, mother of an autistic child, wrote, "Nothing yet has yielded a eureka moment for Aiden, unveiled some ideal child beneath the autism. Instead, it is I who have been revealed, rebuilt, and given a new way of not just seeing Aiden for who he is, but of seeing myself." Kathleen Seidel said, "The word incurable is quite devastating sounding, but you can also look at it as being that autism is durable. Looking at this jewel through different facets does not trivialize the challenges of people who have tremendous obstacles. I'm trying to look at the whole picture, including the beautiful part of it. Autism is as much a part of our humanity as the capacity to dream. God manifests all possibilities, and this is one of the possibilities in our world. It's a part of the human condition, or conditions, as the case may be. For the deaf, medicine and activism are both galloping.